From the California Department of Real Estate, this is First Home California, helping Californians buy their first home. I'm Rick Lopes. The Department of Real Estate has created this podcast to provide you with the knowledge and insights to help you get to a place where you know what to expect during the home buying process and to help make sure you're ready to make informed decisions about what will likely be the biggest purchase of your life. Each episode focuses on a specific part of the home buying process, so be sure to hit follow on your podcast app so you'll never miss an episode. Welcome to our second episode. Today, we're taking a deep dive into how mortgages work. Joining me is Mike Shankman. Mike has more than 20 years of experience in all parts of the real estate industry, including a lot of work with mortgages and financing. Mike is also a lecturer in the Department of Urban Studies and Planning at UC San Diego. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for letting me come on back down.
Hey, you did so well the first time we had to have you back, and we're going to make you stay with us for another episode after this too, because it's so important that we're doing this deep dive into finances. Unless you've inherited a lot of money or maybe won the lottery, you're going to need to borrow money to buy your first home. A home loan is also referred to as a mortgage. So, Mike, let's start by talking about the different types of mortgages that are available on the market.
You know, there are so many mortgages that are out there, and it's such an important decision and something that should be undertaken right in the beginning in your process. I mean, you've got conventional loans, VA loans, FHA. And I think the real big thing to understand is that there's two main kinds of mortgages out there. There's the private mortgage that we look at, and then there's like the government insured. Notice I didn't say government lending, I said government insured, and it's important. We'll delve into that of how VA and FHA works and where they really came from to understand what I mean by that and how you qualify for them. But it's really a matter of looking at how bank sees your risk and what your credit score is, your total liabilities. And then, of course, back to that conversation we had before of not necessarily what you can afford, which is what the bank looks at in qualification, but what you're comfortable with paying.
Great. Since our audience are first-time home buyers, I think it's important that as we go along, we define some of the different home buying terms. So I'm going to go ahead and take a couple of moments and do that. And let's start and define principal and interest.
Well, principal and interest is very simply put, when you make a payment on your mortgage, you are paying part of the principal balance, which is what's bringing down the amount owed. So, you know, if I have a $100,000 mortgage and I'm not paying any interest on it, I have zero interest, I'm paying $50 a month, my balance is going down $50 a month every month, right? The interest is what the bank is making money off of. And it's very simply put, the bank's going to make money. They have to make money. It's a business like anything else. If they don't make money to keep the lights on, they're not able to give you the stuff that you want. And this is how the economy works. So it's important to realize that when you're making your payment on your mortgage, you're paying some principal, some interest. And I know we're going to get into amortization. I'll explain that in depth there. But you're paying a little bit of principal, a little bit of interest, and it's fluctuating over time. And the most important thing to understand is that your balances usually will always end at zero by the end of the term.
Okay, you're going to hear a lot about different types of mortgages, but Mike, can you talk a little bit about the main types of mortgages? And more importantly, what's the mindset and the criteria that banks and mortgage companies use when they figure out things like interest rates and if you're going to be able to qualify for a loan?
It really comes down to the criteria. And I want people to remember, you have to understand how banks work. Now, when I first started my career, a lot of people don't know, I started in as a mortgage underwriter. And it's fun when you get that because I'm a very specific textbook criteria, you know, bullet point sort of person in a lot of things. And then, of course, I moved into being a loan officer, loan manager, and worked my way through the chain. And when you look at it, it's about risk. Okay. Risk to a bank, just like me. If you come to me and say, I want to borrow money from you, I'm going to look at what are the odds of me getting that money back? And, you know, how are you going to make on your payments? How much money am I going to make in evaluating that risk? Well, you got to look at how mortgages used to be as well. Because back in the day, if you look at the turn of the 20th century, when real estate really kind of turned into what it is now and started developing, and they started financing in banks, small community banks would say, okay, like, you know, Rick, you're a good, you know, investment for us, but we're going to look at, you know, what people said about you and what your personal relationship is with us and how our history is with you. And we're going to give you some money. And they gave them much less money. It was usually about 50%. And it's fun because when you look at the history, which I would say, look at history of things on a side note, you can see how policy has developed based on the economic downturns and how much the mortgage market and the real estate market has played into it. That's a different discussion. When I go into a bank or a consumer goes into a bank wanting a mortgage, the bank's going to say, what's your risk based on what? Your credit and your income. And then, of course, how much you put down on the property, which we'll get into here in just a second. But just focus on those first two. okay, which is your credit score and your income. The bank is saying, what is the likelihood that you will foreclose? And foreclosure is what? When you default on your payments and they have to now take the property back. Believe it or not, the bank doesn't like to do that. You know why? Because it is time consuming. It is not cost efficient for them. They don't have staff for these things. It's just a pain in the butt. So they will pay to make sure that they don't have to do that. And that's why they incentivize the highest, you know, credit score, lowest risk people. But it's not just the credit score. So let's still focus there. Your credit score is one end of the spectrum. And then here's your income. So imagine it like a little box. We're doing a four square. And in that four square, you find an interest rate. Well, it's, I'm looking at risk would be my credit score of normal persons is anywhere from like 680 to a 720. That's my opinion. That's someone who has credit, uses credit, takes out a Macy's card here and there, uses their Amazon, you know, card to buy debt, pays it off, doesn't go late, you know, stuff like that. You know, then there's people who are below that. We consider what's called a subprime category. And that's maybe people who get a little bit of a higher interest rate. Why? Because they have a little lower credit, which to the bank means higher risk. So then they look at your income. And income is my ability to pay. So say I have $1,000 in income per month. Okay, just as an example. The bank's going to look at this in terms of a conventional loan, a normal loan that you would get through Bank of America, Wells Fargo, you know, credit union, whatever, and say you can qualify for up to $380 per month. That's total. That's including your principal, interest, tax, insurance, so your mortgage payment, and whatever your minimum monthly payments are on your credit cards. Now, I know most of you are listening right now and you're saying, oh, $380, good luck. I'm just using this as an example because it's looking at that $1,000 income with $380 max. What is that? 38%. And they look at things in terms of percentages. It's called debt to income ratio. You're looking at 38% usually to 45% absolute max for a conventional lender. The lower that is, the more residual income you have. So like residual income, if I'm looking at that same example of $1,000 a month in income, $380 for my maximum payment, that means I have what? $620 in residual income. That's money I spend on formula, my DoorDash bill, my liking to go to movies or spend extra money on stuff or traveling, you know? It's my social habit, my car, my things that I like to do outside that maybe isn't showing up on my credit report. That's your residual income. And that's what they're really concerned with. And now I have to look at what's called loan to value. So if I'm buying a, now I'll keep with the simple example here. If I'm buying a $100,000 home, they want to make sure that I have equity. What is equity? It's the amount that's not covered by debt. Okay, that's the amount that I'm building. That's why we love home ownership. We love home ownership because we're building equity. We're building equity. We're building savings, building things that we can possibly tap into later that we can sell, make more money, buy other properties. We use it like an investment in the back end. Well, if I bring $20,000 into my home when I purchase it, that is my equity. That 20 grand turns into my 20% equity. So I've taken 80% as a loan, 20% in equity. Why is that important? That 20% number has always been really, really important in these things because the bank anticipates when you foreclose, not if, when you foreclose, they will lose 20% of the value of the property trying to sell it. This is why they don't like to do this. It's why they incentivize you having more money down. You're building more equity in the property. It's less risk to them, not necessarily that you'll foreclose, but that they'll lose money if they have to resell the property. They want to get paid back their money. So when you look at these things, all these come into an evaluation of how you get your interest rate. Whereas maybe I can have a lower credit score, but I'm going to have the same interest rate as someone with a higher credit score who's doing less money down because it's an evaluation of not just the risk, but how much money we're losing. And all of that plays together. Where does the income play into that? Very simple. Whether or not you're going to get the loan, period. They want to make sure you make enough money. Sometimes I've seen incentive given if someone has way more residual income, liquid assets, stuff they can easily tap to be able to pay their mortgage. And that interest rate, I know this is for first-time home buyers, but I do want to extend a little bit so people understand that interest rate is all about the risk. So if I have a condominium has a different interest rate because they consider it higher risk. If I have an investment property, that's going to have a higher interest rate. Why? It's higher risk. I mean, Rick, if you have two properties, the one you live in and an investment home, and you all of a sudden can't host this show and not working or doing anything, which one are you going to pay first? Your house. Exactly. If you pay your house, that's what they're looking at. You're going to dump off that rental property and that's going to be a loss to them. So they charge you a little more interest. Anything that's higher risk comes into that. So where does this now come into with the other stuff? The government insured loans. You have to go back to how these came about. Generally, the FHA, which is the Federal Housing Administration, and the VA, and then we have CalHFA, which we'll discuss at the end and in our other program. So what did VA do? It was under the GI Bill, where the troops came back, and they said, look, we want to reintegrate these soldiers into society again. So we're going to give them money to be able to go to school and basically buy a home. And what happened was, is they set up these insurance programs. A lot of people think VA gives you money, that FHA gives you money. And FHA is basically VA for civilians. Think of it that way. Okay, low money down. And since if you have low money down, what do you have? Higher risk, right? Well, we don't like that as a bank. We don't like risk. That means what? Foreclosure means loss. Okay, well, hold on. We got that. We have these insurance companies, we being the government, that we've now negotiated with and negotiated low insurance rates for the borrower, for the client, and they will cover it now if there's a foreclosure. So that's where mortgage insurance comes in. I'll explain the difference between VA and FHA. Let's stay with VA though, because it's easier for a lot of people to understand. So I'm a veteran. I come in. I fought for my country. I want to get a loan. Awesome. We're the bank. We're going to give it to you because the government's insuring that if you foreclose. However, because the government's insuring that, and this is the big difference between government insured and non-government insured, we're looking at the criteria a little different. Okay. We now might have to take this property. So we need to make sure that property is in good condition. This is why you can't do investment loans for FHA or VA. You can't buy them as investment properties. That's not what they're designed for. And also under the VA specifically, you can't do a fixer. So if you're military, thank you so much for your service. Please use the VA benefits, but you have to be careful with the type of property you buy. And as an example, we get appraisals on these properties. And what does the appraisal do? An appraisal is for a bank. It's where the bank comes in and says what the property's worth. And for you, the client, it says, this is what your investment is. You're not overspending or underspending money on this. With a conventional appraisal, they come in, they look around, they're in and out about 5 to 10 minutes. It's pretty quick. Why? Because they're really visually inspecting the property to make sure that the value is there and there's nothing really standing out to them. With a VA or an FHA appraisal, the appraiser's there for almost 45 minutes to an hour. They're checking everything in the property to make sure there's no major issue. And it's important for you to know as a first-time home buyer that it can stall the process a little because there's an extra clause that says on those loans, the VA or FHA, they can issue a list of repairs, things that they've seen saying, okay, we'll give this certificate of value. So say the property's worth $800,000, but it's only going to be worth $800,000 if you fix A, B, C, and D. If not, we can't give you what it's worth. So, and why is it though? Because it's not designed for you to buy an investment. It's designed to help you enter. VA is really for you to enter home ownership. So is FHA. It's meant to help encourage growth, you know, because if I live somewhere, what happens? I spend money at the grocery store. I help the economy grow. I let my kids go to school, you know? And so we always have to think of that, but that's the logic behind it. VA and FHA is meant to help you with ownership. They're great programs. The interest rates are usually right on par, pretty good. And they're insured, so the bank likes the lower risk to them.
We're going to be going over a lot of terms. What we want to start with is when it does come to mortgages, there's four different types of mortgages specifically. So Mike, can you run through those for us?
Absolutely. The ones you can really do are a fixed rate, an adjustable rate, interest only. Then you get in things like based on loan amount, jumbo, et cetera, et cetera. And it really is, I think everything's kind of under a jumbo at this point. I remember back in the day, we used to consider if it was under, you know, $420,000 or something, it was conventional versus anything above that was called a jumbo. And now that's obviously much different. So it's funny how things change. But, you know, fixed rate mortgages are always more secure. 20, 15, 30 year. Your adjustable rate is fixed for a certain term, sometimes called a teaser rate. So we'll have something like 2, 5, 7, 10 year, and then it goes to an adjustable, which can adjust up or down and there's caps on how much it can adjust per period and how much over the lifetime it can adjust. So there's a lot that goes into that. And then there's, like I said, interest only, which is just as it sounds. We're paying just the interest, you know, and when you're paying just the interest, what you got to be careful of is that you're not reducing that principal. The type of interest only or adjustable loans you see, and it's very important for you to know, always end at zero. So if you have an interest only for, like, say, 10 years, for the last 20 years on that term, it's going to be principal and interest. When I say that, the thing with principal and interest, in the very beginning of your loan, you're paying all interest, very little principal. Yeah, they're compounding. And then over time, every month you make your payment, you're paying a little more interest, or I'm sorry, a little less interest and a little more principal. Get about halfway through, you're paying 50-50. And by the very end, you're paying almost all principal and almost no interest. That's a normal, what's called amortization loan. And that's in fixed loans, adjustable loans, even in a lot of the what's called, quote, interest-only loans. At some point, they will go to an amortizing type of loan.
All right, that all sounds good. So now let's address the different places that you can go to get a loan.
You can go so many different places. You can go to banks. You can go to your conventional bank. You can go, you know, to a broker. And I think the biggest thing is, what's the difference between a direct bank and a broker? Personally, I've always loved brokers. Brokers work with banks. You pay a little premium to work with them, but they're able to shop it out. Think of it like insurance. If I go, I can go directly into my insurance company, you know, except if you're in California, you know, we're kind of getting a little more limited on that, but I can go right into an insurance company, or I can go to an insurance broker. Same thing with a mortgage. I can go into Bank of America, Wells Fargo, my credit union. You know, what are credit unions? We have membership there. So, you know, a lot of people sometimes will maybe sometimes get favorable rates by working in there, or they'll be able to help you a little with your criteria because they're willing to take that risk. You know, the thing is I always recommend you compare them, tell them you're comparing them. Don't hide it. They're not going to be offended. It's okay. They understand it. And back when I was in mortgage, we used to always say, if someone tells you they're not shopping you, they're lying. You know, just like dating, we date people and then we get married. Go with the person that you feel most comfortable with and you feel you can trust. But don't be afraid to say, I'm shopping this. Get a comparison. Get a comparison on cost, fees, interest rates. And make sure to look at those. And don't be afraid to say, hey, I got this somewhere else. What can you give me? This is something you're going to be paying for 30 years of your life in the worst case scenario. Make sure you're doing that. It's not a bad thing to compare. It's not a bad thing to be upfront about it. In fact, I used to prefer it. I used to say, make me the last, not the first. And it's okay to go with your gut. In fact, a lot of times your gut is what tells you this is the person you can trust and work with. The one thing I will add when you're comparing, people always say, who should I work with, right? Well, you go with your gut. That's what I always say. If something sounds way too good to be true, it's too good to be true. I'm going to say that too. Sometimes it does work out, okay? But what you don't want to get hit with is the bait and switch.
What about online? You see a lot of money available online where you may not know if these people are here in California. They could be across country. What do you think, what would be your guidance as far as using online companies?
Everything is pretty much online, you know? And that's the whole thing. What I recommend is don't do all your business online. I don't know about you. I'm not letting anyone handle my finances, nor am I letting them run my credit if I don't speak to them. Now, you brought up an interesting point. I remember when I worked in the mortgage industry, which was a while ago. We're not going to say exactly when because I don't want to start crying here on the show. But when I started in that business, I was doing loans on the East Coast, in Illinois, in South Carolina, Florida, New York. I was based right in Costa Mesa up in Orange County. So because our company was licensed in those states and I had my licensing in those states as well. And this is a little bit of a different time. The licensing was a little different, but it's not uncommon. You'll have someone from an outside state doing your loan. A very good friend of mine that works in the industry works both in California and in Florida. And he actually lives now in Florida. His wife's in Florida. So just, again, use your gut. Don't be afraid when you're online, make sure you talk to people. Don't just trust everything via text message. I know we're a society that likes to do that, but go back to the old school way of doing things because that's the safest route for you and your money.
Yeah. And even if people are online or in another state, you can build a relationship. There is still phone, there's video calls. There's a lot of ways you can still do that to overcome that distance.
If I can date someone online, I can do a mortgage with someone online, but I'm still going to talk to them, make sure they're not catfishing me. Okay. So.
All right, let's hit the bullet round here. Let's go through some terms. Let's start with a couple of similar sounding terms that you're going to see when you start shopping for a loan. It's interest rate and annual percentage rate. So, Mike, can you define them and tell us what is the difference?
Yes, I'm very glad you brought this one up because a lot of people ask this question. They go, when you see online advertising or any type of advertising, it'll say your interest rate. And you look at the fine print, it'll say the range of the APR. So what's an APR? It's just what it says it is, annual percentage rate. When you're negotiating, they say the average rate now or that your interest rate is like 5% or 7% or whatever. They're talking about your monthly note rate. You got to keep in mind your mortgages are compounding monthly. What does that mean? Every month, we're compounding the interest based on the principal. So it's calculating what that comes out to be. APR is for you. It's informational. It's meant to say, this is your cost of the loan, which is your payment plus your fees, any other additional stuff that's in there. So here's where I say this. When you get your mortgage disclosure, it'll say, here's your APR. If you have a note rate, which is your monthly rate of say now it would be what, 7%? And your APR is like 14%, that's a red flag. You don't want to have a huge spread between these. Usually a couple percent is going to be there, but I'm going to caution you, don't quote me on that right here because your loan amount can change that a little bit too. There's a lot of things. But if you see a big spread between the APR and your note rate, which is your monthly rate, that's your warning flag that there's some fees or something in there that's jacking up that rate that you're getting charged on. Maybe it's a high adjustable margin or something that could really catapult that. And it's meant to make you wonder what's going on. Keep in mind, the APR on an adjustable mortgage is going to be higher than if it is on a fixed rate because it's going to anticipate the adjustments over time. So you have to take a look at that. But that's meant to be informational in what's called truth in lending to let you see what this is costing you over the term. So it's very important to pay attention to that.
All right. Next term is buy down. What does it mean to buy down your interest rate and how does that process work?
Buy downs we see a lot of right now because of how the interest rate market is, how they're higher. In order to explain that, you have to understand how a loan officer comes about with your interest rate. And maybe I'll get some kudos from some loan officers out there who will thank us at this point, Rick, because I think after this, people will stop calling and saying, what's my interest rate? You know, because a lot more goes into it. So when back in the day when I did it, you know, it was, we had our rate sheets. I know they still have that. And you have to understand what par is. Now, if you looked at a rate sheet, you would see at the top, it would have these interest rates. And it would below that, you would see kind of a range of numbers with everything from one and then to the right of that, which was what? Positive versus below one, which would be negative numbers. Now, as we worked our way up, the bank would pay for the loan versus having you pay for that interest rate. What does that mean? Everybody pays for a loan. Everybody. I don't care who it is. There's a cost associated with every type of mortgage. Now, we used to say you can either pay for it through your closing costs, or you can pay it through the interest rate. Remember, Rick, we used to see those ads all the time that would say no closing fees whatsoever. And of course, we all remember those and we thought they were the greatest things since sliced bread, right? But then you go to get your quote and your interest rate was about 2% higher than it was with someone else. Why is that? Because the bank will actually pay the loan company for a certain interest rate that's sold. Why? Because they'll make money off that interest. What does that mean? Well, right now, the going rate is what? Around 7%, right? Roughly. So let's say 7% is par. That's what we used to call it, par rate, right in the middle. It means you neither get money nor have to give money. So 7% is our par rate. Say, Rick, you want to get a mortgage and you say, look, Mike, I absolutely have to get 6.5%. So what we do is we can do a buy down where the bank will say, on that sheet that I would look at, if the client wants 6.5%, say you have to pay 1 point or 2 points.
Just be clear with everybody. Just explain it. What is a point?
So a point comes out to 1%, 2 points, 2%. So the equation to that is if I'm taking a $100,000 mortgage out, 1 point is $1,000 I have to pay. Right now, we see people negotiating that if, you know, say the purchase price at a certain point, and they're saying, look, we understand that the interest rate increase has done something to you. We'll pay, or the seller will pay for up to 2 points of a buy down. So whatever the cost associated with 2%, that's what they'll pay for you. That can fluctuate. It doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be 1% lower or 3/4. It depends on the bank you're working with.
Yeah. So in other words, the bank's going to get their interest one way or the other. If you want a lower interest rate over 30 years or whatever the length of the loan, you can pay that interest up front as a buy down. So you pay paying the bank the interest up front. And as in exchange for that, you're getting a lower interest rate for the other 29 and a half years of the mortgage.
Correct. And the one thing I always caution people on, though, just know what you're doing when you do that. Because when you're buying the home, you are taking money that you could put towards a down payment and using it to buy down a rate. This is all about math. So double check the numbers. Ask your loan officer, what would the difference be if I gave you that money as a down payment versus if I paid it towards an interest rate? Because there's a sweet spot in there. And if you're already coming in with 30, 40, 50% down on your mortgage, chances are you're going to be able to refinance that later. You know, and meaning that if the value tanks down, you're still going to have equity where you'll be able to refinance if the rates drop too. So just run the numbers on it and see. That's the one thing I've always asked.
Perfect. All right. Next term is loan origination fee.
The other side of the coin, it's what banks make to do your loan, or actually what brokers make or the loan officer makes, which is fair. They're doing a service for you.
All right. Next is impound accounts, a term we talked about a little bit in our first episode.
Yeah, no, with impound accounts, it's your taxes and insurance. Just like we had said in our last time, it's when I'm paying my mortgage, the bank wants to make sure that you're paying the homeowner's insurance and you're paying towards your taxes on the property, because those, obviously we want to insure a home. We don't want to have any loss happen to it. And our taxes, which are municipal fees that we have to pay on this. So they want to make sure those are collected. They collect them from you monthly. So usually the banks will give you an incentive to do it. So they'll say, back in the day, we used to get like a quarter point off of the interest rate. So if you would have normally been 7.5, they would have given you a rate of 7.25 if you made sure to pay your tax insurance with the mortgage.
Yeah, I can say, you know, if you're really good with your money, you might be able to make a few dollars if you kept that money and paid your property taxes twice a year, but you did something with that money. But boy, I tell you, I every time I've had a house, I've had an impound account. It's one less thing to worry about. When the huge property tax bill comes in twice a year, it's taken care of. It makes a lot of sense. And as you said in our first episode, there are different institutions that do require it as part of your loan. So don't be afraid. It's a good idea.
A lot do, and it's important. Now we also go back. Remember, everything comes down to risk to a bank. Everything you do in your mortgage is about risk. The more money down, the more likely they are to say, okay, we're okay with that. Why? Because if there is some foreclosure, the reason this is so important is that municipal liens take first priority. So if the state forecloses on your house, you didn't pay your taxes, guess who's getting paid first? The state, no matter what your mortgage balances are. So if you have more equity in the home, they're like, okay, well, that's fine. We'll let them do that on their own because the state will take their money. We're still going to get ours. That's where it comes from.
All right. The next two are loan-related terms, pre-qualified and pre-approved. What do they mean and what's the difference?
Pre-qualified and pre-approved, there's actually a lot of laughs and discussions on this one. And I say that both very deliberately, Rick, because we've seen people that do pre-qualified, which is, you know, I've talked to a loan officer, we've gone over a couple things, or even I had someone once use a mailer, something that they received in the mail that said you could qualify for this loan and said this is what their pre-qualification was. I mean, someone's kind of just looked at it and said, you know, maybe if everything works out, we're going to give you a loan. Pre-approval means a loan officer has ran your credit, has looked over your income, has ran what's called an automated approval, something along those lines, where they actually have a commitment in some way, an informal one that says, we've evaluated you and this loan should go through. The third level on that, which is in the residential purchase agreement, is what's called a fully underwritten approval. That's your holy grail. That means I put everything through. I've talked to a loan officer. They've submitted that to where an actual breathing person who sits there with their guidelines has looked everything over, evaluated risk, and issued a commitment letter subject to you having an appraisal on the property and a valid contract on the property. So there are three levels. Generally, your pre-qualification is a piece of paper that says you might get a loan. You want at minimum a pre-approval. That's why it's so important, because also you're going to have your payments. It's going to be a little more firm and it's really more of a guarantee. Keep in mind, Rick, the reason this is so important, the number one reason deals fall out is because the loan doesn't go through. And that's why people are so adamant to make sure you're qualifying and you understand where your payments are and you take the steps to really get that through, because you don't want to waste your time, your money. You don't want to end up in a legal issue if you have to back out of the transaction possibly. There's so many things that have to come into play. So usually the best one you want to have at a minimum is a pre-approval.
Great. Last term we have here is something actually comes into play after you get your mortgage, after you buy the house. but it's an important one to think about going into it, is your appraisal. So what does it mean if your new home appraises for less than the amount that you're paying for it?
That's a fun, complicated question. So very important. So in when you buy your home, there's two things you're going to get done, two main inspections, and then we'll talk about later what other inspections come in on a different episode. Your home inspection, which you order for your purchase. Your appraisal is for the lender. So you bring up a very interesting point. What happens if the home appraises for less than what I'm purchasing it for? Well, it says that based on the opinion of that appraiser, the value of other properties all put together means that this home is not the same as what you are offering to purchase it for. Okay. Now, sometimes my appraised value can be higher, even better. Says, oh, look, you have equity in the home. Well, kind of, because what happens, I'll ask you this, Rick, if I have a value of a home that's $200,000, but I decided that I'm going to go ahead and just pay $250,000 for it, what is the value of my home?
$250,000.
And that's what's important to remember. Now, and also concurrently, the other homes around you that are similar are now going to use that as a comparable. So an appraisal is simply the opinion of value as well as the visualization for the bank of what's going on inside that property and what it's worth based on other homes for sale. Ultimately, you decide what price you want to pay. The thing is with a bank's going to look at what that appraised value is, and that's going to be their metric. So if you're taking out a 100% loan at $300,000, right? So you're buying a home for $300,000, not putting any money down, say it's a VA loan, and the appraisal comes in at $280,000, the bank's going to say the maximum they're willing to finance is that $280,000 at 100%. You're going to have to come in with the other $20,000.
Right. So that's the thing is if it doesn't meet enough of what you paid for it, then you might be in trouble with the loan. The bank may not loan you all the money that you're going to need to purchase it for that price.
That's the biggest one. And because a lot of times people say, well, my home's not worth this money. Well, based on the opinion of that person and on the other properties around, it's not worth that amount. But that doesn't necessarily mean you might not find value in it. Now, it's just important for people to understand because people will make that decision to say, well, I will pay the extra money. That is your decision and your decision alone. And I recommend if people do that, they really think, is that what they want to do? And is that the risk they're willing to take?
All right. One of the great things about being a first-time home buyer here in California is there are a lot of home buyer programs that are available to you. We are going to spend an entire upcoming episode on the first-time home buyer programs available through the state's Housing Finance Agency or CalHFA. But we don't want to ignore that here, Mike. So there's a lot to go over, but we're just going to give folks a taste here because there is a lot to digest. So if you can just briefly touch on some of the different programs that people would want to consider that are available through CalHFA.
CalHFA has so many. They have their Cal Plus FHA loan, the Cal FHA VA loan, the CalHFA USDA program. CalHFA is meant to be the California version of the federal programs. So these are slightly, in some cases, higher interest rate, not always, okay, but they follow sometimes different metrics and criteria. They also help you with down payment assistance programs. Those things that we mentioned in our last episode, which can be called sometimes the former term with silent second mortgages. So they give you the money in conjunction with their loan program. If you refinance it, you're going to have to pay that back, but you're not necessarily always going to make payments to that second that's sitting there. It's just basically sitting there saying, we're helping you attain it. What it is you know, state of California, for a lot of times people, you know, you hear opinions about what people think and say, we have a lot of programs that encourage home ownership in the state, understanding how important our home market is. So you just have to make sure, and that's what we'll get into depth on, is that you understand these programs, that you've taken research and time. And I think the most important thing is, because I mean, Rick, you and I can talk about these all day, but the client, the people who are listening right now, you need to make sure you have a loan officer that does understand these programs, that is approved to work with these programs and can explain these programs in depth to you. Because they're just offshoots that are meant to help you by being a resident in California and will help you work for it from there.
Perfect. Well, Mike, you've done it again. We've covered a lot of ground in a short time. Any final thoughts about mortgages and things to remember when you're shopping for a mortgage?
It's so important because a lot of people will tell you, get your mortgage done first. And the consumer will think, oh, they're just trying to not, you know, they're trying to get me to refer to someone else or do this. No, you need to know where you're comfortable in your payments. You don't want to be surprised down the road. You're investing your money. And there's the other thing I like to point out to people. Remember, we said this in the last episode. I want you to be comfortable with your payment. I don't want to worry about where you think you can afford. That's what the bank's going to do. The bank doesn't say you can afford it. They say, based on our metrics, here's what we're willing to qualify you for. And then you will decide if I'm comfortable with my payment. It's very important that you know what level you qualify for based on your income and what the bank's willing to give you. And you know why? Straight out, I don't want to start looking at a $1.2 million home if I'm only comfortable with the payments at an $800,000 home. You know why? The second I start looking at that $800,000 home after I looked at the $1.2 million, I'm never going to find a house I like. And I'm going to drive everybody, myself, my agent, my friends crazy, wishing I had that. And this is just reality. This is human nature. You want to get that part out of the way before you start looking. Do yourself that favor and make sure that you trust the people you work with. You know, I know it's hard to say, but two things people should be able to do. One, go ahead and give a little trust. If you say, I don't trust or I don't like this person, move on. You know, I always compare it like my kid. I remember I called my mom back when I became a parent, when I tried to get some daycare, and I called my mom up one day and I go, Mom, on paper, this person is perfect, but I got this weird feeling. She said, when it comes to your kid, you do whatever your gut tells you to do. I'm going to tell you the same thing. When it comes to your money, you do what your gut tells you to do. If you don't trust the person, don't tell them, I don't trust you. Say, you know what? This isn't going to work. Thank you so much. Go with who your gut tells you after you've done your homework, and don't be afraid to ask questions. Don't feel like you're being bullied and you can stop it right there. You can. You are in control. I'll tell you right now, in the industry, people need you as clients more than you need them as loan officers, agents, et cetera. And I think that's something that a lot of us need to remember. So don't be afraid to ask questions. Don't be afraid to do your homework. And please remember to do that up front, because it's going to save you and everyone else a lot of time and energy.
Mike Shakeman, thank you for joining us today, and thank you for your expertise. Well, that is going to do it for this episode of First Home California. Please be sure to hit the follow button on your podcast app so you never miss an episode. We also invite you to check out the First Home California page on our Department of Real Estate website. The address is dre.ca.gov/First Home California. I'm Rick Lopes, and you've been listening to First Home California, a production of the California Department of Real Estate. Thanks for listening.